shower, you sit there and have a drink. Why?
I don't drink. Can I stay on the bar?
No, you must come here now.
No.
Please.
No, I don't want to.
I'm not doing anything with you.
I know.
You're embarrassing me.
I'm sorry, I cannot. No, yesterday was kind of aggressive for me. I need to know a person to be touched.
I won't do a thing.
I don't do a thing,
please. I swear I won't. Just sit with me. Don't embarrass me in the hotel. I'm here all the time.
I know, but I promise. Don't want to.
And the conversation goes on like that, with Harvey Weinstein trying to convince model Amber Batiliana Gutierrez to come into his hotel room. The recording was made by the NYPD as part of a sting operation. It was published this morning in The New Yorker, along with new allegations against the now ousted co-founder of the Weinstein Company. Among the charges, sexual assault and rape, far more serious than the details revealed in an expose published by The New York Times last week. And in a follow-up story in The Times, the paper now documents new accusations against Weinstein from actresses Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, and others. Through a spokesperson, Weinstein denied all allegations of non-consensual sex. Joining us now is Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, we talked about this last week when The Times published that first story. Now it's in The New Yorker. And how many allegations are there now?
I have absolutely lost count because they're coming out by the hour or even a half hour. The energy that went into the alleged, just predatory activity by Harvey Weinstein is mind-bending, one after another. And now we're talking about, rape.
Yeah. Kind of makes you wonder how he found time to run the movie studio. So these stories about rape, what are the allegations and how many women?
In Ronan Farrow's New Yorker story, I think there are three allegations involving different kinds of forced sexual activity that would be considered, I believe, rape. I don't want to get too graphic, yeah. Madeline. What do I do?
I know. This is radio after all.
Yeah. So, one of the questions in my mind is, what was going on with the Manhattan DA? Mm-hmm. This woman had this tape. It was obviously a sting after she reported to the police that she had been fondled and groped allegedly by Harvey Weinstein. And it has been reported that in some time thereafter, one of Harvey's lawyers showed up at the DA's office with a donation. And this parallels an allegation regarding the Trump children, the
mm-hmm.
kids.
Yeah, we did that story
in which
last week,
something
yeah.
similar has been reported when they were in trouble for alleged fraud. So I gotta imagine that at some point the lens is going to turn that way. But for now, it's still on the activities of Harvey Weinstein.
Well, speaking of Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, A-list actresses now saying that they were sexually harassed when they were a lot younger and beginning in their careers. So what are they saying, and how is that going to change this conversation?
I heard the first I heard of Harvey Weinstein's alleged activities was early 90s, Rosanna Arquette, and mm-hmm. she has come forward now. And the pattern varies somewhat in terms of, exactly what happened. But the general gist of it is there's a meeting in a hotel and suddenly he is coming on very strong and telling these women, to do this or do that, or forcing them. And sometimes tying it directly to I will hamper your career. Mira Sorvino has alleged, Rosanna Arquette has alleged that their careers were hampered because they rebuffed him. So, and in some cases, he pushes these women down and he forces himself on them. And I don't even know, if everyone is giving the full picture of exactly what happened,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so meanwhile, Weinstein is saying what?
He has a spokeswoman, who I have to say I feel somewhat sorry for, because that's a terrible job, denying any non-consensual sexual activities.
Okay. And threatening any retaliatory lawsuits or anything of that nature?
Well, when the first report came out in the New York Times, Harvey had this complete hash of a message, which is astounding given that he had too many cooks in the kitchen. He had lawyers and crisis counselors. Two of them have quit, Lisa Bloom and Lanny Davis. But he initially said, "I'm sorry," and I grew up in a different era. Apparently, the era where, you know, attacking women was okay. I'm not sure we actually lived in that era. And then his attorney, one of his attorneys, Charles Harder, who is known for intimidating reporters and has tried to do it to me and has done it in the past, carried on the Hulk Hogan suit with backing from Peter Thiel and brought down Gawker. He said, "We're suing the New York Times." Now, I think I'll be very surprised if that lawsuit is ever filed, because, of course, that is, on the face of it, seems completely absurd. I mean, you're going to go into discovery and call all these women and have them testify under oath, and then what? You know, that just seems, and Harvey's a public figure, so they'd have to prove malice or recklessness. So, you know, this kind of bully boy tactic that Charles Harder engaged in, I hope it becomes, you know, a mark of shame for people so that they don't go running to him when they're in these situations.
Well, speaking of these situations and the mark of shame, Hollywood in general, is it engaging in a bout of soul searching in terms of the history of this kind of behavior and the so-called casting couch? Do you think that this will finally change things in Hollywood?
I don't know. The imbalance of power is really great. White men dominate Hollywood. The statistics don't budge. They just don't budge. There's all this talk about trying to be more inclusive, and people like Ryan Murphy he's made an effort to have, you know, at least half of his shows directed by women or people of color, and I praise that. You know, I really do. I think the town divides into those who are right now terrified because they know about their own bad conduct, those who were complicit and are soul searching, maybe, and those who are simply appalled because they didn't know.
All right, Kim, thank you.
Thank you.
Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. And joining us now to talk about the legal issues is Lori Levinson. She teaches criminal law at Loyola Law School. She's a former federal prosecutor. Hi, Lori.
Oh, good to talk to you.
Good to have you. Well, let me play some more of that recording, the NYPD's recording of Ambra Battaliana Gutierrez and Harvey Weinstein in that hotel.
Feeling very uncomfortable right
please
now.
Please come in now. And 1 minute, and if you want to leave, when the guy comes with my jacket,
you can go. Why yesterday you touched my breast?
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that. Come on.
You're please. Used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
I won't do it again. Come on. Sit here.
Okay, so The New Yorker reported that after the DA's office heard that and heard her accusations that he had assaulted her, they declined to press charges. She had signed a non-disclosure agreement, and that basically says whatever Weinstein admitted to on that tape that you just heard never happened. So are these cases really hard to prosecute?
These cases are really hard to prosecute, and everybody knows that. I mean, the Bill Cosby case is still going on, and we know how many women, scores of them, came forward on that case. And even though most people think, yes, he did it, when you bring it to a criminal court and you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, it is tough. Even when you have something on tape, they looked into this victim and they saw, I believe, that she had brought other charges against people and then didn't cooperate with prosecutors. That's a signal to the prosecutors that they're going to have a really tough case. And sometimes they don't know about all these other cases, and so they feel like they're out on their own with one particular victim and not likely to win.
Okay, and then there are three stories of rape in the New Yorker article that's out today. Could he face charges for any of those stories, those cases?
It depends on when they occurred and whether those witnesses are going to be strong enough. You know, New York doesn't have the statute of limitations. We have one here in L.A., at least one before the first of this year, where we eliminated the statute of limitations for rape. So I don't know that timing's going to be a problem, but it is going to be an issue about what they said occurred and what witnesses will corroborate them. We just have a problem in our criminal justice system of not believing women when they come in and tell these stories, even though it's excruciating and it's difficult, especially when they're going against a very powerful man like Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah. But do you have to have a cooperating witness?
You don't technically have to have one, but you have to have enough to have the jury, and you never know who's going to be on that jury, actually believe the witness. And one thing we have to remember is that if all of these cases ended up in one trial, there's a greater likelihood that the jury would believe them. But in the Cosby case, the judge only allowed one other incident to be raised, and they got a hung jury, not a conviction.
Given what is happening now in terms of these stories, you mentioned Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, of course, there are the Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly stories, of course, then one involving Donald Trump as well, or many involving Donald Trump. Is there a different attitude now? Does that percolate into DA's offices, prosecutors' minds in terms of whether or not to pursue these cases when so much is happening in the public sphere?
I certainly hope so. I hope that prosecution offices are taking this as seriously or more seriously than they ever have. I think sometimes it takes a change in the personnel in prosecution's offices. There was a time where the people making these decisions just didn't relate as much to the crime, but I think that has changed. Having said that, however, they still have a responsibility to evaluate a case outside of the public glare and say, even if I think he did it, can I prove it? And those are two different things.
Lori Levinson is a professor of criminal law at Loyola Law School, former federal prosecutor. Thank you, Lori.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we'll check in on one of the worst fires in California history next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'm sure you've seen some of the pictures. Parts of wine country in Northern California look like a war zone. Homes, schools, businesses, vineyards in Napa, Sonoma, and Santa Rosa reduced to ash. Strong, dry winds are intensifying these fires, which are already among the worst in state history. Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency for Napa, Sonoma, and Yuba counties. Sean Scully is editor-in-chief of the Napa Valley Register. Hi.
Hi.
All right. Well, tell us what you're seeing and just the devastation that you have witnessed.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, these fires were intense. One of the one that hit Santa Rosa actually started over the mountain in Napa. In Calistoga, within sight of my house. So I saw this just towers of flame. And Sunday night, the winds were gusting. It was like, you know, Santa Ana winds. In Southern California, it was gusting 40, 50 miles an hour, and each time it did, these towers of flame would just shoot up. And then here in Napa, I'm looking at the burn map right now, and there's four sort of separate fires, but they're all over the place. I mean, there's dozens of little hot spots, houses gutted. It's just amazing.
Yeah. And I read that this happened so fast and with such strength that people just had to run out of their homes and they couldn't bring anything. They just had to run for their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to overstate how quickly these things moved. I mean, everybody went to bed at 10 o'clock on Sunday thinking everything was fine. And by 11 o'clock, all hell had broken loose at both ends of the valley. It was just completely amazing.
Any idea what caused these fires?
We don't have any idea. In fact, the firefighters are basically telling us at this point, we're just trying to save lives. We're not counting. We didn't get our first incident report from CAL FIRE until this morning, which is unusual. Usually they'll do it within a few hours. But they've just been so busy trying to save lives and save animals because this is it's burning through some agricultural areas. So horses, goats, it's just amazing what's being evacuated. Mm. So they really haven't had time to even tell us what's burned and what's not, let alone what might have caused it.
Yeah, I've seen some stunning pictures of nursing home residents having to be taken out fast, people in hospitals being evacuated, on their gurneys in the street. And at least 12 people have died? more?
That's what we hear. We've had two over here in Napa. In fact, we just got the identities this morning. It was a couple that had been married 75 years, and I did their anniversary announcement back in March myself, and and so they're the only deaths here. There've been much more in Santa Rosa because it raced down the mountain and into the developed part of the city in just no time at all. Mm. So that's where the worst death has been.
And Napa, we of course think of vineyards. Have vineyards been affected?
Well, the funny thing about vineyards is they tend not to burn because they don't have a lot of underbrush. They're very well irrigated, so they actually tend to present a fire break usually. Now these fires are pretty intense, and so we don't know if any vineyards have burned. We certainly know of wineries that have been damaged or destroyed, but the grapes themselves, it's a little hard to tell.
Okay, and this is just after Napa recovered from that earthquake 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, we were all just kind of beginning to put it behind us. You know, most of the damage is repaired. We ourselves lost our building, and so we moved into a new building a year ago, and it's lovely, and everything's wonderful, and then this happens. And one of the fires actually in Napa is right in the same neighborhood that got hit the worst in the earthquake. We don't know yet if any, you know, sort of quake-damaged buildings were burned. We're not at that level of detail, but certainly it's blowing through areas that were heavily hit by the 2014 earthquake.
Okay, I want to bring in Anna Jabert right now. She's joining us from Napa, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And so what has happened to you?
Well, what happened was the night of the fire, like your host was talking about, it came up so quickly. I was in my bed, and my parents came running at around 11:30, pounding on my door, telling me that I had to go, that there was a fire that was coming. Apparently, my father went to shut a window that had blown open, and he saw the flames coming and just decided to leave. He didn't leave with anything. They left with nothing. They grabbed their dog and themselves, no computers, no nothing. And I grabbed some things, and we all just ran out, and I followed them out. We ended up going to Denny's because it was the only place that was open 24 hours, and we parked in the parking lot. And we proceeded to stay there all night, sleeping in our cars.
Oh, my gosh. And so have you returned to your home?
Yes, yesterday. We couldn't hear anything, and there was absolutely no phone service. And my dad was desperate to see what had happened to the house and the condo. And so they ended up walking, parking their car. They wouldn't let them in. They walked the 2 miles up to the house to find it burned to the ground.
Burned to the ground?
Mm-hmm.
You've lost everything?
He lost everything.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry. And so you had gone to bed thinking everything was just fine, and you know.
I knew there was big wind. There was big winds. It was blowing like crazy, uh-huh. But I went to bed thinking everything was fine. I had no idea anything was going on.
Wow. So what are you and your family going to do?
Well, we don't know just yet. My father is waiting to hear. We're staying in Berkeley, waiting to see what they don't even know, honestly. I mean, I think they're trying to decide what they can do based upon the coverage on their house and whether they even want to rebuild or not. They're right now in a state of complete shock.
I can imagine. And do you have anywhere they can stay or...
We're now staying in Berkeley at a hotel for the next 3 days, and according to what I saw in the news, Napa is still under evacuation orders, so we're unable to go back even to the condo.
And so I imagine, how long had they lived there, your parents?
Well, they've been living in Napa over 10 years, and there for the past 8, it was their dream home for them and their family.
So they must have had a lot of, you know, mementos and things that they treasured that are now gone.
Oh, absolutely. You know, a dresser from my grandmother in Spain who's passed away, and the family photos, they were not high tech, so they did not save any of their photos. They lost everything. She didn't even get her passport out. So.
Well, I'm really, really sorry. Condolences to you and to your parents.
Yeah, I think that the hardest thing for everybody, including all of their neighbors who lost their homes as well, there was not so many neighbors that also... which randomly just blew through the entire neighborhood, and other homes were completely devastated, close friends. that we were unable to have any contact or any information. I think that was the hardest thing, is that I got 1 point separated from my parents, and there was no way, unless I was standing by the Nob Hill grocery that had Wi-Fi, to get any. They had no, there was no coverage, no Wi-Fi, no nothing. And I think everybody was just wandering around in a state of shock, trying to figure out how to communicate with one another, and nobody knew anything about what was going on. I ended up calling ABC News to find out, because they were the ones that were doing the most reporting, if there was a hotline or anything, and they gave me Nexus, I think. But there was just no information, and I think that was the most devastating part, too, that nobody could get in touch with anybody or their loved ones.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. And again, I'm very, very sorry for everything that's happened to you.
Yeah, I want to say prayers for everyone else and all the families and businesses who lost both their lives and their businesses during this tragedy. Thank you.
That's Anna Jabert. She lives in Northern California. Sean Scully, still on the line now, editor-in-chief of the Napa Valley Register. I imagine you're hearing a lot of stories like that.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, sadly, it's not unusual at all. I mean, her story is exactly it. People had no idea the fire was coming. They really had no warning because it moved so fast. And then one of the problems we're having is that the fire tore through some areas that have major cell towers, transmission lines, even water lines. You know, one of our major pumping stations on the east side of town burned up in the fire, and they're struggling to try to keep water pressure up so that they can fight fires over there. So this tore didn't hit the main part of the city, but it tore through some areas that have some really key infrastructure. So cell service is bad. It's a very bad situation.
So how will, I know it's very early on in this, the fire still needs to be put out, but how will residents be able to rebuild?
Well, I think they're going to have to think about whether they want to. I think it will probably cause them to think about, fire safety. It's easy to get complacent about that, not clear underbrush and that kind of thing. And that's what, fire agencies warn about constantly. So I have this feeling people will be looking at the building codes and thinking very carefully about fire safety. But, these are beautiful areas, desirable areas, and this sort of thing doesn't happen all that often. I mean, the one of the areas in Napa that is burning now had a terrible fire back in 1981, but that was a long time ago. They really haven't had anything serious since then. So I have this feeling people will rebuild in most of these areas.
Sean Scully, editor-in-chief of the Napa Valley Register, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the city of Inglewood is changing fast. Is that a good thing?
Once you really start seeing white people walking with dogs out, there it is right there.
Our series, There Goes the Neighborhood, continues next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's time now for our series, There Goes the Neighborhood.
We all grew up, attended public schools here. Our families are here. And to have entities to come in and essentially destroy our communities is sickening.
This neighborhood has, just a long history of disinvestment. Now that we're seeing investment coming in, we want to be able to take advantage of those investments, right? We want a home court advantage.
To me, gentrification is a polite word for white people coming in. And unfortunately, that's just how property values increase.
People pull up and say, why did you buy here? This is a black neighborhood. You're not black. And it's sort of like, okay, let's talk about that. I hear where you're coming from, and this is who we are. This is why we're here.
I don't want to live in an all-black neighborhood. I don't want to live in an all-white or all-Spanish. I want a rainbow culture of people. Bring everybody in here.
Los Angeles is changing at a very fast rate, and that rate is almost blindsiding some of the African-American communities that have been here for an extremely long time.
There goes the neighborhood.
This week, There Goes the Neighborhood is in Inglewood. The new NFL stadium and surrounding development promise to remake that city. Home prices are up, so are sales. So what does that mean for the character of Inglewood? KCRW's Anna Scott and Saul Gonzalez have our story.
Recently, KCRW reporter Anna Scott interviewed a guy who lends money to real estate investors. His name is Jerry Ducott. She asked him for his advice on LA's real estate market. Here's what he said.
You should be buying in Inglewood.
I was surprised at first. Certain LA neighborhoods come up over and over again in conversations about gentrification. Highland Park, Echo Park, Silver Lake. Those are the places you find the $7 lattes and the expensive new condos. Those neighborhoods all fit a kind of LA gentrification paradigm. A Latino community on LA's east side sees large numbers of white people move in. Inglewood, however, doesn't fit that mold. For a long time, it was a largely black city, and it doesn't have many white people. At least not yet.
If you're a Lakers fan of a certain era,
Magic Johnson is entering the game.
Or watch the series Insecure on HBO.
Spot looks so much bigger than it felt.
I know. It's gonna make some young white couple really happy someday.
Or listen to music. You know Inglewood. Like many black communities, it's sometimes gotten a bad rap from pop culture. Let me just play you this scene from the 1991 movie Grand Canyon. Kevin Kline's car breaks down at night in Inglewood after a Lakers game.
Yeah, I need road service for, let's say Inglewood.
The camera pans menacingly across a liquor store. Then, a car full of young black men blaring NWA pulls up.
Mayday, mayday, we're going down.
Why don't you get out of the car?
After that movie came out, Inglewood officials wrote an open letter to Hollywood. They called Grand Canyon an assassination of an entire municipality's character. Now, it's not that Hollywood completely invented Inglewood's problems. For decades, it saw high crime and failing schools. But it's also a longtime bastion of LA's black middle class. More than a third of the city's residents own their homes.
I grew up right across the Inglewood border in South Central, and then actually bought a house here myself in 2004. So I've never really left.
Erin Aubrey Kaplan has been writing about Inglewood for more than 20 years, including as a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. She lives in a ranch-style home on a quiet suburban street in Inglewood.
People sit out on their porches and talk, and it's kind of this transport of Southern culture that still is around. It's not upper middle class. It's working to middle class, but people aren't just struggling to survive. There's that tension of being in poverty, and I know that too. So there's kind of this space to talk and breathe and talk about racial struggle, but also talk about other things, like how's your lawn doing? And so it's that kind of space that brings together a lot of different elements of the black experience, the middle class, the working class, the historical past. And it doesn't exist certainly nowhere else in LA or LA County.
Right now, Inglewood is in the crosshairs of developers, speculators, and moneylenders like Jerry Ducott.
Inglewood is because of its geographical location and all the activity taking place in Inglewood is a great opportunity.
In 2 years, a new light rail line is expected to open, connecting the city to the airport and downtown LA. The Forum, where the Lakers used to play, has been revamped into a premier concert venue. And the biggest thing, an NFL stadium, the most expensive one ever built, will be home to both the LA Rams and the Chargers. It's under construction on what used to be the Hollywood Park racetrack. And it's more than a stadium. It's part of what's supposed to become a $3 billion city within a city. It'll have thousands of new housing units, a hotel, stores, restaurants, a theater with 6,000 seats, 4 parks.
2 lakes, and I like to say, and a partridge in a pear tree.
That's Inglewood Mayor James Butts.
This is going to be a development that's going to be 3 times the size of Century City, 3.5 times the size of Disneyland, and twice as big as Vatican City for perspective.
He says Inglewood is a city on the rise. In the past 6 years, it's recovered from being on the verge of bankruptcy, and crime has fallen steadily.
And there are Inglewood residents who are profiting from the changes.
Ready, set, go! Oh yeah, that time!
Every Sunday, a group of local men meet at the Inglewood Forum's huge parking lot to race small radio-controlled cars.
Crap, those are fast.
Yeah.
How fast do they go?
Oh, we've topped these cars out just in, right in here, over 80.
It's here that I meet Leroy Clavin. He's a painter and a handyman. And as we talk, he points in the direction of the future NFL stadium.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm liking it. I'm liking it. And I've been making money off of it. Yeah, I'm in the construction, so a lot of people are refurbishing their properties near this stadium, and a lot of people are coming in buying the dirt around this stadium. And I have been making a lot of money in the last year and a half off of this. I ain't gonna lie. I've done like 9 projects over here.
So for you, it's good. Bring the boom on if there's a boom.
Bring it on. Bring it on. It's bringing money back into the area.
What's happening in Inglewood, though, isn't just about a stadium or a light rail line. Remember Jerry Ducott, the moneylender, talking about its geographic location? It's about much larger economic forces squeezing LA's West Side housing market and pushing demand east. Inglewood's a short drive from Silicon Beach, where hundreds of tech companies have opened offices along the coast. We're talking Google, Facebook, Snapchat, YouTube, and Yahoo. They've created thousands of high-paying jobs.
If you want to buy a house in that area, be prepared to spend. In Venice, the median home value is upwards of $1.5 million. And if you're looking to rent, good luck finding anything affordable.
Hi, how are you?
But if you purchase a house in Inglewood, it costs a lot less.
So if I'm a young tech worker, maybe I've just moved to LA,
you would
say great house to buy?
Yeah. I mean, this is a cute little house. The neighborhood has a lot of people who've lived here a long time. Somebody on the street said that they've lived here for 10 years and they're a newbie.
That's real estate agent Lucy Williams, who I meet at an open house for an 800-square-foot Inglewood cottage. Its list price? $400,000.
And I could be in Silicon Beach in how many minutes from here?
Less than 15, I would say. Depends on traffic, but yeah.
Like everything in LA, depends on traffic.
Why is Inglewood still so cheap? The answer has to do with history and race. I asked Erin Aubrey Kaplan, who you heard from earlier, why she thinks LA's Latino neighborhoods gentrified first, before its neighborhoods with large Black populations.
I think people are less frightened of Latinos. Black people give everyone pause, particularly poor Black people. No one wants to live next door to a poor Black person. They just don't. Black people are scary to most Americans. I'll be honest. They are foreboding. They're forbidden. There are laws specifically written to keep them out of society.
Those laws Erin just mentioned, well, they were actually racial covenants, explicit language and property deeds that prevented homes from being sold to African Americans and other minorities. It was also really common for banks not to provide mortgages to people of color. Go back more than 50 years, and those practices helped to keep Inglewood largely white.
You couldn't go to Inglewood because we had the post office right there at 83rd and Western. And you couldn't cross Van Ness. See, that was a line. You cross Van Ness, that was Inglewood.
George Smith, who's Black and in his 70s, remembers those days.
This side of Van Ness was L.A. And you couldn't go over there to even buy a house. If you went over there, what are you doing over here? You don't live here, you know. If you're going over to a movie or shop, the police would stop you. What are you doing over here, you know? Well, I'm just driving through. Well, keep going then. I thought you was in Mississippi or someplace.
Then there's this guy who remembers the old days very clearly, right down to the fight song for Inglewood High.
Cheer, cheer, cheer for Inglewood. Inglewood, we're for you, here for you to cheer.
That's my father-in-law, Jack Frost. Yep, Jack Frost is actually his name. He's a white guy who grew up in Inglewood in the 1930s and 40s, and he describes it as a pretty idyllic place then, except...
Inglewood wasn't a very nice place in a way, and that it was quite racially segregated, I guess is the word I want to use.
Like, Blacks weren't welcomed.
Right. I went to high school there and graduated in 1947. And at that point in time, we had no black people in the school.
6 days of rioting in a Negro section of Los Angeles left behind scenes reminiscent of war-torn cities.
That changed after the Watts riots in 1965 and the resulting white flight across L.A. from the city to the suburbs.
Firemen were harassed by snipers and brick-throwing hoodlums as they attempted to control the fires, many of which were left to burn themselves out.
Real estate agents also helped speed along racial change. Historian Wade Graham.
The way it worked was if you could take advantage of somebody's situation and get them to sell to a black family, you could then go door to door and tell the white homeowners that their property values were going to plummet and they needed to get out fast before it got even worse. And you could grab those houses at a discount and then sell them at an enormous profit to African Americans who were desperate for somewhere to live.
Erin Aubrey Kaplan knows people on her street who were witnesses to that change.
I have a neighbor around the corner. She moved here in 1967 when Inglewood was largely white. And her neighbor, who's a white guy, would come out every morning on his porch and say to her, "What are you doing here?" And by the end of the summer, the entire block had changed and just became all black. And she laughs about that story, but I think it's a painful story. What does that feel like to move somewhere to start to achieve this dream of integration? And then everybody leaves. So now we are in 2017, faced with the prospect of white people coming back. On the one hand, we know property values go up. On the other hand, we know this can't work because history has shown it can't work and it won't work.
When we come back, can Inglewood gentrify without sacrificing its black community?
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, back to There Goes the Neighborhood, our series on housing and gentrification. KCRW's Anna Scott and Saul Gonzalez are in Inglewood.
So, is gentrification a zero-sum game in Inglewood? If white people start buying in the community, does that inevitably mean black people get pushed out?
Hi, Henry.
Hi.
Hey.
How are you?
Good.
Again,
Anna.
Here's Anna Scott.
Nice to meet you.
Meet Henry Menacheri.
Okay.
Henry is a real estate investor. He raises a lot of money from Hollywood executives. His company is called Universe Holdings.
It's sort of a vision my father had that one day we have properties all over the universe, thinking big.
Henry came to LA from Iran when he was 15 in 1978. He has a simple formula: buy apartment buildings, renovate, raise rents, then hold on to the properties for a long time to bring in a steady cash flow for investors.
We generally don't like to sell property. We like to buy property.
So Henry and his team are like gentrification bloodhounds, and they've followed the scent to Inglewood.
We saw rents back in 2014 that were 70, 80 cents a foot. We hadn't seen that anywhere in L.A. for years. I'm like, you know, what's going on over here? This is like the rents of 20, 25 years ago. So Inglewood looks like a great buy.
In the past 2.5 years, Universe Holdings has scooped up 7 apartment buildings in Inglewood.
Would it ever become the West Side? Who knows? Probably not, because it's just behind the times. But we look at this as a growth stock. We think there's a lot of room to grow because we're starting at the ground level.
You know, one of the reasons Inglewood has been undervalued is because it's been a largely black neighborhood for many years. And as black neighborhoods gentrify, often there's a racial change and they become whiter often. I guess I wonder just what you think about that and how you think about your role in gentrification.
You know, when people who've been living in this community for the past 30 years, 40 years, see the change, it's going to create a lot of inspiration. And that invites more people to come in. And I think it's nice that the area gentrifies because people learn to coexist amongst other racial types, and it could create a very nice, cohesive community.
But what about the nice, cohesive community that already exists? I asked Henry if the area can gentrify and stay largely African-American. He kind of sidestepped race and said, hey, LA is booming. We have all these new industries now, like the tech sector. There's more prosperity, and that creates winners and losers.
If people can't elevate themselves economically by working harder and getting better jobs, there's going to be no choice for them but to move to the less affluent neighborhoods.
Henry has faith in the market. But the market is not an even playing field. One study published last year by UCLA and Duke University found that the median wealth of white households in Los Angeles is 89 times what it is for black households.
Some people in Inglewood already feel the financial pressure of guys like Henry coming in. Renters. Unlike the city of LA, Inglewood doesn't have rent control. We went to one of Henry's properties, a two-story apartment complex. It's built around a square central courtyard. A few kids were playing there. I asked if any of their parents were home. And a few minutes later, a guy, about 50 years old, came down to the courtyard. He asked to go by the nickname High C. He's afraid using his real name might get him in trouble with Henry, his landlord. Yes, High C says his rent's been increasing.
It started going up last year around November or December. The rent went from $1,325 to $1,875.
That's a 40% increase. High C shares a two-bedroom with his girlfriend, his daughter, and two grandchildren.
Everybody else as a minority is basically being pushed out. That's what's happening right now, so.
You see that happening, or you think you see that happening?
No, it's happening. If you go probably 3 miles north, what they used to call the jungles in Baldwin Hills down there, it used to be like, it had a bad name as far as saying that it was like bad because there's a lot of gang and drugs and everything else around there. But now you have a lot of whites and Asians that moved in there, and you would actually see them late at night or early in the morning walking their dogs through these posted men bad neighborhoods. And not to be like saying a stereotypical like statement, but once you really start seeing white people walking with dogs out, there it is right there. Matter of fact, it's a couple of white families moved in here already. And then they build in a rail system on Crenshaw. So if you look at everything together, it's really not for us. I guess the first cupcake shop goes up, it'll be official.
And guess what Aaron told me?
Oh, you know, there's a new cupcake shop. We have a cupcake shop now right around the corner from me. I figure that's a good sign, right?
I told High C what Aaron said.
There it is. It's official.
Aaron is a homeowner. If Inglewood property values go up, she could make a lot of money. Her fear isn't about being priced out. It's about the future of Inglewood's black community. And not just because of this new talk about gentrification. In 1990, Inglewood was 50% black and 38% Latino. Since then, those numbers have flipped.
Inglewood, even though it's a concentration of black people, is heavily Latino. So the new people who moved on this block have been Latino. And that quote-unquote displacement has been going on for quite some time. I don't mean to sound like a hostile takeover, but it's been changing anyway. So that you add that to the gentrification prospect, and it's very nerve-wracking for a lot of black people all over LA. I got an email from my neighborhood listserv. Someone just sent out a message, don't sell your house, don't sell your house, stay put.
Erin has lived in other parts of LA, but she says they felt anonymous to her. Living in a largely black neighborhood is something she treasures.
I really know everyone, and we all talk a similar language. We have similar interests, and that's community.
The mayor of Inglewood, James Butts, is familiar with this sentiment, but he says the city's open to everyone.
People that can afford to buy a house that someone else wants to sell should be allowed to move here. And to have any consideration that that person is white, that's just a big non-starter as it was in 1960 when the current residents cared if that person that could afford to buy a house that someone wanted to sell was black.
Of course, what do you expect the mayor to say? Butts has made it his job to bring new investment and money to the city. Erin wants to see new investment, too. She'd love to have more sit-down restaurants, a new grocery store. But she says history doesn't show us a good track record of black communities getting those things and staying black.
Why can't that happen? It happens in other neighborhoods. Other populations expect certain amenities when they live there. It's kind of, you know, it's the American sense of entitlement, I guess. And we've never been able to share in that. And that's real equality. When you move somewhere and Trader Joe's comes to you, I call it retail justice. It's not the same as racial justice, but we've kind of substituted it in our mind. If we could just get that Trader Joe's, that's equality.
But the possibility of getting that Trader Joe's now feels bittersweet.
People have been asking for decades for certain things improvements, better this, better that. And somehow it only happens when this gentrification process starts. And until that happens, nothing happens.
Race is ready. Set, go.
In the parking lot of the Forum, Leroy, the handyman who races those radio-controlled cars, well, he has mixed feelings, too. Even as Inglewood's changes help him.
Now, it's going to price the poor people out. You know, you got to give and take somewhere. It's going to price them out.
So when you're working on your projects here and you're refurbishing homes and remodeling places, are you playing your own little small part, do you think, in gentrification, honestly?
I do feel that. But what can I do? I mean, I have a large family to feed myself, so.
And African-Americans beyond the city limits of Inglewood have anxieties, too, about their future because of gentrification and changing demographics. Black residents now make up about 9% of the city of L.A.'s population, or nearly half of what it was compared to 1980. There are very few majority black neighborhoods left in L.A.
There also is an anxiety about kind of a disappearance of black folks in the city.
That's Regina Freer, a professor of politics and urban studies at Occidental College. For years, Regina's neighborhood, Leimert Park, has been a crossroads of black L.A. life, with African-American-owned businesses and cultural institutions.
Is the cultural hub of Leimert going to include black people as residents and kind of stakeholders in the wealth that's generated, or are they merely going to be the performers of black culture and for someone else?
Looking to the future, Regina says she totally understands that change is inevitable in Los Angeles. She just hopes there's a strong and large enough African-American population here to help shape those changes.
KCRW's Saul Gonzalez with Anna Scott, wrapping up this episode of our series, There Goes the Neighborhood. Next week, house flippers come to LA's inner city.
I want to buy every property for a dollar. Basically, I want everyone to just hand me properties and titles for deeds and then just walk away and high-five me and say, have a good day. If it makes dollars, it makes sense.
That's next week on There Goes the Neighborhood. Our series is also a podcast. You can find it at kcrw.com or on whatever podcasting app you use. All right, Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback. And I just want to note also that there is a live event that Saul is going to host tomorrow night. And that's going to be at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center in Leimert Park, I believe. And that is about this very issue that we've been talking about. Who benefits, who wins, who loses when gentrification happens?
Yeah, they're going to have a panel of experts talking about what happens in some of these neighborhoods and whether these kinds of investments in those neighborhoods can also benefit longtime residents as well as people who are moving in. So that'll be really interesting. Feedback on this gentrification piece, a lot of interesting stuff. David Benoff says the black middle class left Inglewood. It did not leave Southern California. Many middle class black families left Inglewood for the Inland Empire, the Antelope Valley, etc., in order to escape the criminally mismanaged Inglewood school district and secure a better future for their children. Monster Taco says council members like Gil Cedillo let Jeffrey Palmer, Trump's biggest West Coast supporter, build giant unaffordable stucco boxes. Liz Dwyer says sadly the benefits of gentrification, cleaner streets, nicer stores, improved schools, only seem to come after people have been forced out. Bobby Duke doesn't see a lot of benefits. He says there's mostly increased homelessness and harassment by police, which are not, as he see it, as he sees it, benefits. And TW agrees. He says, name a benefit, a single one, that is shared across income levels. Mm. So not a lot of positive feeling out there about gentrification.
Not a lot of love for the gentrification.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, that's why our series is exploring that. There's so many gradations,
fascinating angles,
so many
yeah.
interesting ideas there. All right, and you can check it out again when you get your podcast, so you can listen to all the series. So far, 3 episodes. Christian Bordahl, thank you very much. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.